Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Fucking
dude, you need to get this straight.
Because
you do this every time.
I do this with every episode and every guest. And you know what? It's the least of my worries. If I get the number wrong, it's not going to...
Well, he said it was 227. It was actually 228. Does anybody feel...
Like, it has no bearing on anyone's experience of the video. If that throws you for a loop, I don't know what to tell you. The internet might not be for you. If that's your barrier to entry, you know, you might want to work on some starter steps, like tying your own shoes and brushing your teeth. On that note, Roger Williams, who I've had two people comment on I think the first time I had you on, but I've had two people comment on that in the last week.
Two comments in the last week on my episodes.
I screenshotted and sent them to you.
Yes, I got them.
Yeah, I'll read them right now for everyone listening. Let's see. First one was, someone commented on episode 169. Unknown last mate commented, please release the second book. And then yesterday, Angivel, A-N-G-I-V-E-L. I love the metamorphosis of Prime Intellect. I've read it several times, and I'm still waiting for the transmigration of Prime Intellect, Topi. I Google it every once in a while, hoping for an update, but alas, I haven't found anything. I tried to find some way to contact Roger directly, but either he doesn't have any contact info publicly available, or I just fucking suck at looking for it. Side note, you just fucking suck at looking for it, because I found him in like 30 seconds. Hey... I'm not shitting on you, Angel. Thank you for being here. Thank you for enjoying the podcast. But just, I mean, come on, Google Roger Williams, Metamorphosis of Prime Intellect. That being said, Roger, if you indeed see this, which he is, are you still working on Transmigration of Intellect, or should I cry myself to sleep and give up hope? I do that anyway, regardless of Roger's work, so that might help, just falling asleep crying. I heard of and intend to read the Mortal Past trilogy as soon as possible. So shout out Angivel. Anyway, you've got two fans who are indeed, because you said you messaged me and you said that you sold 17 copies in one day.
Oh, the thing is that there was something else going on, because that turned into over 100 copies over the next 5 days.
What the? I link your book in the top comment of every episode you're on.
I mean, no offense, but I don't think it was something else going on somewhere.
No, if it was one or two, I would have been like, got you, Raj, but not me.
But you are catching on, because I've got a couple of fans through you now.
Woo.
Which took a bit. So, okay, whatever. And I responded to both of them in the comments myself.
Okay.
So anyway, my plan for tonight was to do a dramatic reading of some excerpts from the curators.
Fuck yeah.
And it will be a very dramatic reading, because as we are doing this very moment, Hurricane Zeta is hitting me outside of my office there. The eye of the storm will probably pass within about 20 miles. Probably while we're doing our podcast. Yeah.
Is this podcast going to be on Live Leak?
Just as a warning, because I probably am not in any real danger from this storm, because as I often tell people in southern Louisiana, we laugh at Category 2 storms, but it is very possible the power will fail.
Okay.
And so if I suddenly go dark, then I will have to contact you on the cell phone and let you know what happened, and then we might have to...
I got you.
Get back, But I'm not really expecting that. Yeah, it's just, I mean, we've been in the cone of, like 5 times before this year and didn't get hit. In fact, I've got coworkers who have been like, yeah, we're in the cone, which means we won't be in the cone once the cone moves.
The fuck?
Because weather forecasters don't know what the fuck they're... It's like, no, it's... That it's not really the way it works.
Yeah.
So, no, this time we're in the process of getting hit, but it's a small, compact, fast moving storm. It's all going to all be over by midnight. So, yeah, it's just like, it really just started raining hard, like maybe half an hour ago.
Really? So just not. All right. Well, hopefully a 2x4 doesn't, you know, impale
you. If this podcast goes the usual length that we do, the whole fucking hurricane is going to pass while we're talking to one another.
Hopefully, I was going to say, hopefully, a Volvo, you know, it's Ron White. It's, you know, for that hurricane, it's not that the wind is blowing, it's what the wind is blowing.
Yes. And the thing is, you know, the real big problems that we typically have are things like floods. We're not going to have that because it's a small, compact, fast-moving storm. It's not going to pile up big storm surge. It's not going to dump a bunch of rain. The main problem is the wind. And the main problem is that we haven't had a good, strong storm to winnow the trees since Katrina. Ooh. So there's a really good chance that a tree will fall on a power line somewhere and everything will just go black. So, yeah. But that won't mean anything's bad to happen. I'm just like, I seriously don't expect anything bad to happen to me over this. It's just, you know, my wife has been cooking shit all day so that we won't have to, you know, in case the refrigerator goes out and all that. But, maybe. But it's been just like with everything else in the fucking year 2020. Everything is all fucked up about this year.
Yeah, just let it ride. It's 2020. Just got to skate this bitch out.
Yeah.
There's no way else to do this one. We just got to ride it. The fuel's out on the plane. We're coasting. Hey, we're coasting. Whether or not we survive the landing, that's out of our hands now. We're coasting, all right? So let's just, you know, let's eat the crackers. Let's drink the complimentary Diet Cokes and whiskey. Maybe we survive this and we walk away. Maybe we hit a granite face. That's we'll come to that bridge when it gets here.
Whatever.
Right now, we're coasting.
So, Annie.
On that note, let's get into a podcast.
What I wanted to do was because you liked the description that I did of some of the things from the curators about the character Andrew, is I wanted to do a dramatic reading of the Andrew monologues, which are 11 very short excerpts from about halfway through the entire series. The series itself is close to 200,000 words in length. It was about 120 episodes. But around the middle of it, I switch narrators. In the first, you know, there are four books, and the books are defined by the relationship humans have with this galactic civilization that they have found exists. And for the third book, I switch narrators from the human who started it in episode one to one of the curators himself.
Okay.
A human form curator, and he will introduce himself in the first reading that I do pretty well. But I felt that he would be a better first person viewpoint for the things that I wanted to deliver in the rest of the story.
Okay.
And so, but to lay things out, this is a story where humans develop faster than light travel in the 2040s. And we find out very quickly that there is a galactic civilization because our initial experiments attract one of their fold ships to the Earth.
One of their what?
Mainly.
One of their what?
Their fold ships.
Fold?
Yes. Their ships work by folding space-time.
Okay. Yeah. All right, yeah.
Which was just an idea that Heinlein and Asimov used a lot. And this was a more popular idea of how star travel would work before Star Trek. Really, before Star Trek, most science fiction writers would have told you that warp drive or something like that is not really believable.
Yeah.
Because there's a whole shitload of equations that describe physics that say that faster than light travel is not possible.
Yeah.
But what is possible is what amounts to teleportation, where you cease to exist at one point in the universe and you suddenly exist at another point in the universe. None of those equations forbid that.
Okay.
So that is what you have. So in the curators, it is the fold drive.
Okay.
That, you know, folds space. So distant parts of it are together.
Yeah.
And you can transition.
Yeah.
So the aliens detect our initial efforts and come to make sure we're not going to do something stupid, because it turns out that the fold drive is incredibly dangerous if you don't understand it perfectly. Because if you don't have it calibrated correctly, if you do anything wrong, it can fold your planet into the middle of its sun.
Okay. Small print. The fine print.
Yeah. Details.
But
it turns out that we actually do have our shit together in the 2040s when we're doing this. And so we sent our experimental craft to do these experiments near Mars so that if we got it wrong and some planet got folded into the middle of the sun, it wouldn't be the Earth. We weren't that stupid. Okay. Many things transpire. Like I said, this is a series. I initially thought this was a thing that I would maybe do 10 episodes of. Turned into like 120 episodes. Spent 2 years on it. And actually, I'm very proud of it. It's, you know, considering at no point in this series I had any idea what was going to happen more than maybe 10 episodes in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And that was at the outside, at the beginning of book two, where I was figuring out geopolitics and how I was going to unify the governments of the Earth. Most of it, 2-3 episodes out, I had no idea what was going to happen. I was like, it was an experiment.
Yeah.
And it worked out so much better than I ever expected. So anyway, what I plan to do, what I am about to do, is for book three, I switch narrators. Books one and two are narrated from the viewpoint of a human who had an alien show up in his, he was a dermatologist, and an alien showed up in his office. And that led to him being the first ambassador from Earth to the stars. But after many, many interesting things, I decided, well, you know, that character had kind of gotten to a point where I didn't feel he could be like the center of the action anymore.
Okay.
So another character was a friend who was actually one of the curators who was a member of this mysterious group of beings that created all of the life in the Milky Way. They are the reason the Milky Way has habitable planets.
Okay.
And they are my answer. The whole reason I started the curator series was I am very convinced by the rare Earth theory that there's a lot about the Earth that is very coincidental that makes it stable for a long-term evolution of complex life forms like ourselves.
Yeah.
And if you look at this, if you read the book, you know, if you look at the rare Earth theory, then it's like, yeah, there's no other habitable planets in the galaxy. It was just a fucking astonishing coincidence that everything went right here. But my solution to this in the curators to get a Star Wars cantina type galaxy was, it was created.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is one of the guys who created it. And I'm going to look over there where I have the source code and read. There are 11 excerpts. And then there's one from the greater story that I want to read to complete it. And I will pause after each of them. I'm sure you'll have plenty of questions and interesting comments about it.
Fuck yeah.
So
yeah, I'm just, so you know, I'm going to sit back and listen, and I don't want you to think that I'm just, fuck you, Roger, I'm out. This is,
oh no,
I'm listening. I'm a guest on this podcast.
Okay. Yes. Okay. So
let's do it.
Andrew comment number one. 60,000 years ago. I was born into a tribe of nomadic hunter-gatherers. They had a rich technology, but it lay in the fashioning of stone points and spears and mastery of the atlatl. My people had not yet invented the bow as a hunting weapon, but they did use it to start fires, and they lived by numbers. They counted the days, they counted years, they counted lunar cycles, and they reckoned the passing of the seasons with a precision that would astonish a modern human. They reckoned our age in months rather than years, and I was 55 moons old when the big cat snatched me from the campfire. My tribe had well-made torches, and they fearlessly set out after me, but the cat's teeth were buried deep in my flesh. The cat did not understand this fire thing that made light in the night, and when my people caught up to it, it dropped me and ran for the darkness it had been expecting. My people brought me back to the camp, and the shaman did what he could, and my parents wailed prayers to the gods that they thought might be listening, but it was obvious they had no way to fix what the animal had done to my small body. In the middle of the night, they simply left, leaving me to the wild. It would have been more merciful had they killed me themselves rather than leaving me to die alone, but I can understand why they couldn't bear to do that. My panic and terror were dissipating as I lost strength, but then strangely out of nowhere, I felt new strength. When my fear reasserted itself, a powerful internal voice told me, in a strange language that I strangely understood, that this was not useful. There were flashes of light that seemed to be chasing away the predators that wanted to make a meal of me, and then one of the gods my parents had taught me about came to collect me. It was an animal that stood on two legs like a human, but was fully furred and had a long snout. It scooped me up in its arms, and then everything around us disappeared and changed. From that moment on, I never lacked for any necessity of life. My people had lived in constant danger and privation. My tribe had made sure I knew of the years when old people had to walk away into the winter dark to make sure the rest of us had enough to eat. But my new family had plenty of everything. They always had good food and clean water and could make light and warmth wherever and whenever they needed those things. And whenever I wondered about any of it, I found that I simply knew. I found that I knew the number 201442, which was the index of the world where I had been brought to mature in safety. And I also knew the number 1742660, which was the index of the world where I had been born, and to which I would eventually return as an agent of my saviors. I found that I knew all these worlds were arranged in the form of a spiral wheel called a galaxy, and I knew a common language which would allow me to speak to any of the residents of those worlds, who were generally not gods, but just mortal animals like myself with varying talents for technology. I was destined to be a god, though. I was being recruited to be a curator, to join those who tended the garden of the great wheel and guarded its equilibrium. I remembered 18 different lifetimes lived in bodies of different form and talent. I remembered nearly a million years of experience during those lives. I remembered that emotions are dangerous and distracting, and I remembered how to suppress them when my human body insisted on distracting me. I had been given a gift my parents and my tribe could not even begin to imagine, and I was intent on using it well. It is one of those shortcuts of language that we say the curators take a new host. What actually happens is we offer that host the gift of our experience, and it even occasionally happens the gift is rejected. But not in my case. I accepted the gift of my implant's memories and the wisdom and the further wisdom and skill of the curators themselves and swore to do their bidding in a galaxy that was huge and confusing and sometimes unpredictable, particularly in the matter of uncurated races such as Homo sapiens. I am human. I am not an alien in a human body. I am a human with the memories of aliens to draw on for guidance. And I trusted that guidance for nearly a million years before I found that it was sometimes foul.
Is that the first one? All right. I like it. I dig it. So, all right. So, which weirdly enough, dude, I had a dream last night, one of those like super realistic, photorealistic dreams. And I was outside and I saw like a weird shape in the sky, and it started materializing on like a crystal clear night up in the mountains, and it was it was a fucking alien craft, like Independence Day size. And it started to like come into our dimension. And it didn't travel like faster than light. It started like hopped out into our, it started materializing. And I was terrified. It wasn't what I thought. It would be like, oh, they're here. It was like, oh my God, run. But I like that idea that it's not that this being realized he was, it's not that he woke, kind of like Alan Watts, it's not that he woke up and remembered he was a god, right? He's receiving this, right? It's not that he's, so he's not inherently a god. He's receiving this.
He has an implant.
Okay.
And the implants are super advanced. Okay. And the way that the curators work is that if you start out, if you're going about your life as a curator and you have an implant, though, that gives you certain superpowers, but also it's recording your thoughts and your the state of your mind. So if your bioform gets killed, your implant goes into emulation mode. So your personality persists. And at that point, you can go looking for another host.
Okay.
And what happened to our narrator is that it was suggested to him that he should find a human host.
Okay.
Because the curators wanted to observe our world. And he accepted this assignment. And so the implant with this ongoing personality finds an individual who needs to be mature enough to have formed all the appropriate imprints, to live a normal life as that, a member of that species.
Okay.
So you know what to eat, yeah. you know what smells right and all.
Yeah.
You have, somewhat appropriate social parameters, but not old enough to have formed really higher level directives, like long-term goals and imprints and all. So those come from the implant personality. And so the curators have been doing this for literally billions of years. Okay. So they have it down to a fine art.
Yeah.
They basically designed us. They designed our world. They didn't design our particular world, but they came up with a recipe for making worlds that are likely to be habitable, that have to have a moon, that have to have plate tectonics, have to be within a certain weight range, that have to have a certain solar system around them. And they've been going around for billions of years making worlds. So that's why the rare Earth isn't rare in the story universe.
Yeah.
The curators made it.
Yeah, yeah.
But the comma, the little footnote in the story is that for whatever reason, which is not known at first,
it's not 100%.
The curators didn't curate us.
Okay.
Normally, when a species reaches what they call the critical path, they come in and they start giving gifts. They give the gift of knowledge, of writing, the gift of fire, the gift of writing, the gift of, nuclear energy or whatever's necessary in order to get them to the point where they can do space travel.
Okay.
And they didn't, apparently they decided we were too violent. And they thought we would probably just end up killing ourselves.
Or
dead. Which is a thing that will come out in the monologues that I'm about to do here. So that's like the backstory.
Okay.
So
I'm buckled up. Let's go.
Part two, or number two. 8,000 years ago, the curators had recruited a handful of human agents around the time they recruited me. Humans had already spread beyond Africa, throughout most of Asia, and even as far as Australia. Our mortality cure included epigenetic switches that let us modify our appearance so that we could continue to fit in as humans adapted to new environments. My beat was the part of the world known today as the Middle East, and I fit in perfectly as I watched humans develop agriculture, cities, and their first national empire without any help from the curators. Normally, by this point in species development, the curators would have helped them acquire a uniform language, fire, writing, arithmetic, Arabic numeric notation, agriculture, and other gifts, and our existence would be common knowledge. But the decision had been made not to curate humanity before I was recruited, and our presence was a formality to verify the decision-making process. There was some surprise that humans had attained so much on our own with no help from us. And without knowledge of our existence, humans were making up their own stories to explain where they had come from and how their world worked. In order to get as close to the forming nexus of power as possible, I posed as a scribe and allowed myself to be enslaved. This was, of course, a sham, since you can't really restrain someone who can simply fold out of your cage or restraints at will, but they didn't know I could do that. As a scribe, I was a valuable slave, and such I became both the property and trusted confidant of the young king. I was careful not to reveal any knowledge or skill that I hadn't seen some other human demonstrate, but in order to make myself valuable, I did have to pose as one of the most talented and well-trained humans to acquire their skills naturally. "Learned scribe, I seek your counsel," the king said as I was at my work. I put away my materials and turned, giving him a slight bow. These new royals had not yet developed a craving for the elaborate rituals of servitude, which would become standard eventually, and it was enough for me to show simple respect and obedience. Whatever my...
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I may offer my liege. Our crops are in, and they are more bountiful than ever. My soldiers are confident that they can expand my domain by conquering one of our neighbors, taking their people as slaves, and eliminating them as a threat to ourselves. You know exactly how much we have in surplus, so I seek your counsel as to the best course of action. This was one of those times when I knew something I shouldn't have known. They were not rotating their crops, and so the fertility of the soil as they were using it was a finite resource. And with their population density, which they needed to make agriculture practical, they needed those crops. Going back to hunting and gathering was not a realistic option. "My liege, your vision has led us to a great place," I said. "But no one has ever tested the fertility of our mother goddess as we are doing. Should her bounty fail in a year or two or three, we might need today's surplus to avoid famine. But scribe, our storage houses have already overflown." "My liege, if the crop fails next year, we have only barely enough to cover that year. We would then have no surplus to expend on expanding our borders to plow new lands. And if that is if we leave this year's bounty in storage." "Do you think the crop might really fail?" "There is so much we don't know, my liege," I lied. "Our storage overflows only because we haven't built much, because we've never had such a surplus before. Perhaps before committing to expansion, it might be prudent to build more storage and improve our defenses against vermin so we can build a cushion against hardship." "For how long should we take such a timid posture?" "Not timid, my liege, but careful. We have 2 years of bounty, and we don't know if a storm or flood or drought will undo us. I would advise giving it 7 years. Use the time at our surplus capacity to build strong silos of brick so that vermin can't get in, and fill them up so that if there are lean years coincident with your next bold move, they will not undo all your works." I knew the soil would begin to show its burden by then. They might be able to replenish it by irrigating from the river instead of waiting for the seasonal floods, but it would take them time to learn how to do that. "That is sound advice, scribe. Thank you for your counsel." And of course, 4 years later, the crops failed, and I became such a hero that I had to disappear in order to avoid becoming more a part of the human story than the curators wanted. Even so, the story of my council was retold and attributed to other kings and wise men in turn. With much embellishment, that became my first appearance in the Christian Bible.
I love it. I love it. I love it. It's perfect. I don't know how good of a host I'm going to be this episode, because right now I'm like, all right, keep going. Number three. Like,
okay. Okay. That's good.
All right. Yeah.
All right.
Keep going.
Number three. Okay. 2,800 years ago. Oh, by the way, when I say years ago, that's from about 200 years in our future.
Okay.
When 2,200. This is all set.
Okay.
So 2,600 years ago from our point of view.
Okay.
Humans still hadn't figured out that their world was a collection of finite resources, and the first empires of Macedonia crumbled as the rich forests were cut down to make fields which only remained fertile for a few years before more had to be cultivated. Agriculture remained practical along the rivers, where regular flooding replenished the soil, but the population thinned as the forests were converted to deserts, and the interesting action moved to the Mediterranean basin, particularly Egypt, where the Nile made long-term agriculture more practical, and India and China. Even with the ability to fold anywhere on Earth in our long lives, it was difficult for the handful of human curator agents to keep up with the ebb and flow of human conquest and collapse. I heard tales of a secretive school on a southern Italian island called Croton, where some of the ideas of which I was told seemed remarkably progressive. This turned out to be only partially true. It was a small paranoid club that taught asceticism and some odd philosophical ideas, along with the beginnings of an understanding of mathematics that was new even to me. Those teachings were heavily rooted in visualizations of shapes and an exploration of their geometric properties. I had to also swear to my colleagues that I had not somehow given them the idea that souls are immortal and return to new bodies after death. After all, in their circle, that was only true of me. Unfortunately, they completely eschewed practical applications of their philosophy and regarded some concepts, such as the existence of the dodecahedron and irrational numbers, to be too dangerous to reveal to those outside the group. So at the time, I was fairly sure nobody would remember Pythagoras or his followers. The graphical geometric method of approaching mathematical problems was new and seemed very clever to me. All curators have implants, which are fairly powerful supercomputers, even by modern human standards. So we tend to use numerical methods to solve problems, and we have long known the solutions to those equations we might need to use. And we tend to give those answers to our curated children as needed before they need to work them out from first principles. It has been a long time since any of us has had to work out something as basic as a trigonometric relation using only our brains and lines drawn in the sand. But even though the Pythagoreans did have some ongoing influence, particularly and most importantly on Aristotle, none of the thinkers of that era could move past the idea that such lofty thoughts might somehow be soiled by their application to everyday practical matters. And so those lofty thoughts remained curiosities which had little effect on the lives of most humans. Number four. 2,000 years ago. If the Greeks were hindered by an excessively philosophical approach to those ideas that might have made advanced technology possible, the Romans had the opposite problem. They were nothing if not ruthlessly practical, both in their aspirational architecture and their engines of conquest. But they considered math and geometry to be tools of the rough trade of building, whose members existed to serve the exalted whims of their masters. The arts of reading and writing were too fine to be wasted on such ordinary people, and so their arts were handed down by apprenticeship and word of mouth, and thus completely lost when the empire folded up. The Romans would eventually conquer everyone within range, except for the Egyptians, who had the resources of the Nile Valley to draw on. That range was limited primarily by the time it took their armies to reach a destination on foot, a range they extended by building the finest roads any of us, including we here mayor, we human curator agents, had ever seen. Of course, this also required them to practice a very casual brutality, which always came up when we pointed out what humans were doing to those of us who had sent us to watch them. Human success would always be a temporary aberration, we were assured. Such a society could never be stable, and the collapse of the Roman Empire after a succession of increasingly self-absorbed and outright insane emperors seemed to confirm this. But from the ground on Earth, we could see another facet of this that other curators refused to acknowledge. Since we had denied humans the tools that eliminated scarcity and granted power, those who wished to eliminate scarcity or acquire power had little choice but to enslave their neighbors. Their agricultural techniques were primitive and hard on the land. Their architecture and engineering were also all dependent on manually manipulating things that could be found on the surface of their world. This required much backbreaking labor, which was often coerced by the threat of violence. I spent as much time with the Roman engineers who were raising aqueducts and vaulted domes as I did with their emperors. The fact that humans had managed to raise any kind of civilization at all was amazing, and the fact that that civilization was cruel should not have been surprising.
I love that, because it's the first... It's the first, like, slight... I don't know if rebellion's the right word. To the curators, it's like... They're starting to have their own... You can see their bias. Like, you know, it's... You could almost imagine, like, you know, us. Like, two white guys in 2020 America and being, you know, our long Egyptian cigarettes. Like, see, that's why these African countries are so dangerous. And it's like, well, dude, they don't have anything. They don't even have water. They don't have a toilet, you know? So... You got to kind of got to be cutthroat. And we're like, they're all warlords, you know. Let me tell you how it is. And it's like, it's very, you know, it's kind of like the upper class of the Titanic being like, ah, those peasants are so loud. And it's like, they don't have anything, man. Their life expectancy is like 30 years. Like, they're just, you know. It's Roger, I'm going to go grab a little a lamp because these overhead lights are giving me a headache. But
okay. Hey, I'm not in a big hurry. Storm hadn't wiped me away yet.
Storm hasn't come yet.
I'm good.
Yeah, I love that idea, though. It's like the first time a kid starts to question, or like a teenager starts to internally think, maybe mom and dad don't know what's best, right? It's that.
Yeah, that's well, what as hinted at the end of the first of the very of the first segment, yeah, Andrew's had a couple of come to Jesus moments at this point.
it makes and every time they have violence, it's like, see, this is exactly what we said. And it's like, well, that's a self let me go get a lamp real quick. Roger, monologue, please.
Hey, and we are broadcasting from the ongoing wind field of Hurricane Zeta, which is probably not going to blow me away because this house survived Katrina without any problems. So my bigger worry is that the power will go out and this podcast will come to an abrupt end. Other than that, yeah, hey, okay. It's raining.
There we go.
Well, that was dramatic.
No, sorry, Ed. It's
we got that backwards. See, I'm the one having a hurricane hit. The lights are supposed to go out on this end.
Oh, fuck. No, Tower 7's supposed to collapse first. Oh, fuck! The lights overhead start to give... I did an episode earlier, and it starts to give me a headache after.
Yeah, I understand that. All right. Sure. Yeah.
All right, back into it.
All right, so, number 5. 15th century CE. After the Roman Empire fell, it seemed that the human race probably was doomed. There were promising developments in China, quelled by conflict and invasion. Accountants on the Indian subcontinent finally worked out a positional number system that made advanced math possible, but then they didn't pursue the advanced math. Islam pushed an explosion of new philosophy and technology, which would eventually bring the Indian number system to Europe. But then the Ottoman Empire settled into the all-too-familiar pattern of mad leaders and corrupt bureaucrats. Then everything seemed to come together in Europe. The knowledge of the Roman engineers had been forgotten, but the older ideas of the Greek philosophers had been preserved, sometimes in only a few copies, but it was remembered because it had been written down, and now it was studied by people who were inclined to make practical applications. The errors of Aristotle's wisdom were gradually discovered. Gutenberg invented a way to make books mere non-royals could afford. Kepler worked out how the bodies of the solar system moved, and Newton worked out why. Other people realized that while their quasi-religious search for an elixir of immortality was probably futile, the experiments they had been conducting were revealing other more mundane ways to usefully manipulate the material world. Much of this new wisdom was spread through letters written on newly inexpensive rag paper by people who are basically hobbyists with enough wealth to have some free time. I found the role of carrying those letters useful, as it gave me a chance to spy on their content as their writers progressed in their ideas. Our supervisors assured us that it would collapse again, and we human agents resigned ourselves to recording that inevitability. But what then happened was both much more spectacular and much worse than anybody could have imagined.
Okay. Keep going.
Number six. 18th century CE. The ocean-going caravel sailing ship made it possible for the Europeans to do what the Romans had only been able to dream of, mapping and nearly conquering the entire world. Diseases and vermin made their way to every corner of the earth, and casual cruelty was the order of the day as human enterprise continued to need those inputs which are not being provided by a nanite infrastructure. The European monarchs thought they were the masters of their universe. But then the Americans asserted their independence, and in their wake, other colonies realized that they had resources which could be used against their distant oppressors instead of to benefit them. The dissolution of those empires took some time, but it was inevitable once it began. Then the Americans had a civil war, fundamentally based on the last gasp of slavery as a human institution. Human civilization still needed the labor, but were now favoring economic bondage rather than outright chains as being a less ugly and ultimately more practical method of controlling people. The Civil War featured an explosion of new technology developed toward the end of making more effective war, and at its end, more than 500,000 Americans lay dead on the killing fields. I wore both blue and gray uniforms in order to study that war, and I had to fold myself out of danger more than a dozen times. I thought that was a lot at the time. The Civil War seemed like an awful thing, and other than the act of folding a world into its star, it was objectively one of the most awful things anyone could remember happening in the entire history of the galaxy. But humans are really very good at whatever they decide to do, and they were just getting started.
I'll keep going. I'm
number seven. 20th century CE. The story of human ascendance has, unfortunately for many individual humans, been the story of human power. Not having the nanite-based economy of plenty to provide needs, when humans wanted more, they could only acquire more than they could acquire by hunting and gathering. They had to start by acquiring power over other humans in order to marshal the labor resources they needed to do what the nanites could have done. We human curator agents were directed to study human nexuses of power in order to verify the curator's prediction that humans would ultimately destroy themselves. This study took us to many places and times. We were there in China and in Mesoamerica and the Indian subcontinent and, of course, in Africa. But the chain of power that led to humans' explosive technological expansion began in Mesopotamia with an idea that the leaders of men somehow attained their authority from the gods that men had invented to explain how their world worked. This led through the Greeks to Rome with a side trip to Egypt, and then to the creation of the Christian church in a really crass political move to undermine the pagan religious leaders of the Roman Empire. The church then survived the empire that had created it, and for a millennium it was the absolute power of Europe, more powerful than any monarch until both military advances and observations of secular reality began to chip away at its authority. At first, when the monarchs sent their soldiers and caravels to conquer the world, they took priests with them. But gradually, the empires became the real powers over most of the earth, and the Church of Rome became a venerated but mostly impotent relic. But then, even the idea of monarchy began to lose its divine luster. Finally, in an era of global trade made possible by ocean-going ships and railroads and the new factories powered by new machines, capital and those who managed to control it became more powerful than even monarchs. Just as the pagans and Christians had jostled for position before Constantine made the move that created the Catholic Church, in the 19th century, it was capital and aristocracy which vied for power, and nobody realized the aristocrats were doomed. Insinuating myself into the presence of the new capitalist movers and shakers without actually helping them required some creativity. I started by associating myself with artists as a student who was never quite good enough to be remembered for my own work. My association with people like Matisse and Picasso got me invited into the presence of their patrons. I made myself into an inoffensive student who was liked because I listened well and I heard much. I was there when ground was broken on great museums and libraries and on vast industrial and civil works. But then, knowing what the situation was, I was also there within days to trace the consequences after the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand.
Oh, fuck. All right, so it's speeding up. Yeah, and I like the evolution of all of a sudden the flow of capital being the fluid in the oil tanker that sort of jostles it. Like you said, it's less about the priests and, you know, the divine right of the gods. And it's more about, you know, who's got that paper.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And it's okay. But but that's what I'm getting from it primarily, is that it's speeding up.
Yeah.
It's starting,
I'm thinking this is going to push all your buttons, man. Okay. I'm just saying. I thought this would push all your buttons.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, it's... Okay. Keep going. You got me.
Okay. Number 8. Early 20th century. The oddest thing about the Great War, obviously no one yet knew it would eventually be called World War I, was that nobody seemed to know why they were fighting. Everyone seemed to be in the conflict because someone else was, not because they wanted to be. Yet the tangle of relationships among the aristocratic class seemed to make it all necessary, even though nobody would admit to wanting it. The internal combustion engine made tanks and aircraft possible, and larger, faster firing, more precise firearms, and made the killing fields far more lethal than they had been for the Americans 60 years earlier. Some of our agents had to fold ourselves out of danger more times in the short course of that war than we had in 60,000 years observing the human race. I had to personally fold away from 2 different sinking ships. It was the most futile and violent thing anyone in the Milky Way could remember. And while those who directed us were quite smug that this signaled the impending demise of humanity, we agents on Earth noted that when it was done, the humans buried their dead, rebuilt their cities, generally resumed trade among themselves, and continued to exist rather robustly. Meanwhile, a man named Edward Bernays, taking advantage of early private access to the work of his uncle, Sigmund Freud, was inventing the human's most dangerous technology yet, the ability to influence each other en masse through the techniques of propaganda. a tendency toward rationalism, which had been gradually pushing religion aside, abruptly reversed course in many ways, and large populations were efficiently and deliberately manipulated into enthusiastic support for things that should have been very obviously against their real interests. When World War II began, nobody was in any doubt as to why it was being fought. It was spun up through fomented xenophobia and launched out of crass greed. The propagandists did their job too well and convinced themselves of their own superiority and the subhumanity of their enemies, and they acted accordingly. Their enemies saw how this was done and reacted in kind. And this time, the technology was even more dangerous. Tactics had also improved since they had the example of World War I to study, which did not really help since the weapons were so much more powerful and the players so much more ruthless. Of course, we became aware of the giant project the Americans were undertaking to realize atomic energy. Nobody in the galaxy had ever bothered to try this, and we weren't convinced ourselves that it would work until the Trinity test. And at that, the six of us who had been recruited to live among the humans all those thousands of years ago decided to hold a rare personal meeting to decide what to do about it. It was now clear that our curator handlers were just as wrong about everything as the humans might well be. If we just watched while the humans did what they might be about to do, we would survive. We might go into emulation, but we would all take new hosts. And we would have to live with the memory of whatever we were about to experience on Earth for a very long time.
Okay, I like that. I like that. I like that on two fronts. I like the transfer to nationalism. As you said, we're moving away from towards the gradual march of materialism and eroding, theistic structures. Yeah, I was like, I like it. Go to nationalism, spin them up, and it's like going from silicon to carbon, right? You hit a new paradigm. You start to hit an asymptotic curve, and then you kind of turn into an S curve, and then you hit a new one, right? It's we're moving away up. Are they figuring it out? Nope. Propaganda, the psyche, whip them all up, and then I like that. They start to believe it themselves. It's like, oh fuck, is it just the Japs, or is it now are we starting to be like, we gotta fucking kill the Japs, right? It's whipping that up. I like I was gonna say the A-bomb. I like that. We didn't think was possible, but it's kind of like, this is full on fucking ego, but in a way, it's kind of like this podcast. That's how I can see it, is because if you're limited, right, limited resources, that's the only way they have to subjugate their fellow man. That's the only way they can progress without the nanite backbone. It's I've had people, one guy I talk to a lot, he always says, I gotta ask you, he's like, how do you have your reach? It's like, how do you get some of the guests you get? And I'm like, And now I can only write it off as like, well, I'm 30 and I live at home and I'm desperate to get this thing up and running. So it's just like, fuck it, send out a million emails. I'm going to get a man that walked on the moon. But it's kind of like that resource limitation, because it's like, when you're not limited, you never push it that far. So why else would you try to build an atomic bomb? Because otherwise you don't really have a reason to. But when it comes down to World War II and the stakes are so high, it's like, we didn't even think it was possible. But now these guys are fucking around and it's like, holy shit. They did it, right?
Mm-hmm. And Tommy, you are like the poster child for perseverance. I mean,
thank you.
That it's like you had one of the four remaining living people who walked on the moon on your show a couple of weeks ago. I mean, okay, yeah, it's You obviously still got room to grow, but you have proven you can start from literally just like
a laptop,
nothing,
a laptop and a backdrop,
a laptop and an internet connection, and the sky is the fucking limit.
Fuck yeah! But I like the relation to the curators though. It's because you would think, it'd almost be like a Rogan, right? I can imagine a Rogan is like the curator. Like, I just never tried to get on one of the Apollo moonwalkers because I never needed to. But then you look at it with the resource limitation, right? I could be, the nanite backbone would be funds and a revenue, yeah. right? And I don't have that. So it's, you stretch what you have to the limit.
Well, also think about it. Suppose Rogan calls Charlie Duke and Charlie's people blow him off.
Yeah.
And you're Rogan. It's like, yeah, fuck that shit. But for you, it's like, well, hell, everybody blows you off. It's like, what the fuck? Might as well try, right?
Even Charlie gave me a soft no like four times. I just kept poking him, and finally he was like, sure. He said sure. And I've reached out to him several times since then. I don't think he wants to do it again. But shout out Charlie Duke. Point being is until you're pushed to that absolute, because you can push yourself really far out of curiosity, but when it's really no longer convenient, you're not going to do it anymore, right? But when it's, you know, if you see how far you can swim as an athlete, you might be able to do 500 laps. But if you're out in the middle of the ocean and your ship sunk, you might see yourself doing the equivalent of 3,000 laps because you don't have anywhere else to go. Right. That's where I kind of see it. No one else tried to build an A-bomb because ultimately it's not worth that much money, right? 10% of the U.S. power supply, $2 billion in 1940, all the enriched yet. You don't need it, really.
But we also didn't know that we weren't going to be facing this, like, global coalition of everyone else in the world united against us after it had been unified by one of these two Axis powers.
Yeah.
So that was, you know, having that was, you know, it wasn't actually as necessary when we completed it as we thought it might be when we started it.
Yes. Yes.
But it was, you know, it was one of those heroic things.
Yeah.
Like the Apollo program.
Yeah.
That seems kind of crazy in retrospect.
Exactly. But that's exactly what it is. It's like, holy fuck, they went to the moon, and it's like they had to. It was like, we got to beat the Soviets, right? Yeah. It's like, I don't think,
because otherwise they're going to have fucking radiation weapons up there or something. Yeah. You know, it's like, who knows why?
Yeah. It's kind of true. Like, we needed the nuke because it was like Hitler's going to get it. But then, like, Hitler was gone, and it was like, and then it just became convenient to drop it on the Japanese. Like, if we really wanted to, and Russia would have bolted.
Well, the problem at that point was by the time we realized that the Axis, you know, that Hitler was not going to get it, we had spent so much money that not completing it
was a waste.
And not getting a result was not an acceptable result.
Yeah.
And so they literally hid the fact that we had discovered the Nazi atomic program, and we knew its extent, and we knew it was futile, that they had never sustained a chain reaction, and we had in fact confiscated all of their uranium and brought it back to use in our shit, but they didn't tell the people at Los Alamos any of this.
Well, because they wanted to keep the hustle going. You're right, you gotta get an ROI on it, right? We put so much into it.
So it's like, you spend $2 billion in 1945. You got to show something for that.
And you could almost argue that, like, we needed it because we thought the Germans were going to have it. And then once we found out that their shit was bunk, we knew we didn't need it for the Japanese. But I could see that the very upper echelon, like even above Los Alamos, you know, like the president's circle, I could see them saying, we do need it for the impending Cold War.
Well, one of the wet blankets on the whole thing was Leo Szilard,
who was
the person who thought of the nuclear chain reaction in the first place.
Yeah, when he was walking across the street.
Yeah, I can tell you've read the making of
2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 16. Yeah.
And he's trying to tell people to test the bomb is tantamount to giving it to our enemies, because once they know it is possible, the true secret of the atomic bomb is that it is possible to make them at all.
Okay.
And Szilard was trying to tell them that, and nobody was fucking listening, because all they were hearing was, we spent $1 billion. We have to finish this thing.
Yeah, we dumped the money in.
Then, as you read in Dark Sun, you know, Szilard was right.
Yeah.
And once they knew what we could do, our enemies went and did the same thing, because if you're a country, it's not really all that difficult.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so there we are. And yeah.
And welcome. Yeah.
And that was even before 2020.
Yeah. But what's kind of crazy is, like, there is an argument for the power of the bomb in that, in terms of gross deaths and percentage, it's been steadily declining since 45. There's something to argue for that. I get the argument against using it. I do. It's not my argument, but I completely understand it, and I could argue it if I needed to. But there's something to be said for, like, deaths and violence was going up for, like, 10 millennia, and it's been dropping roughly since August 9th, 1945. Maybe correlation isn't causation, but I don't know. It kind of does.
Yeah, well, it did scare the, you know, it did make everyone crap their shorts.
Including us. Like, yeah. Including us. We were like, you know, it's like if you snap and you punch someone and, like, you broke their, like, nose.
I did that?
It's that, oh, shit. Like, they're scared, but you're kind of scared. You're like, I can't, I might go to jail.
I had a coworker 20 years ago, this young guy, Baton Rouge, and he was literally one of these guys whose hobby was going out on Saturday night and getting in a fight in a bar. And I remember his buddy telling me, it's like, oh, yeah, he don't do that no more, because, you know, he thought he killed this guy. It was like, and he was like, you know, this dude's flat out, you know, it's like, and the guy that I was talking to was like, oh, yeah, I think you killed him. That's a dead guy. That's a dead guy. And then there's like, and the fighter guy was like, what?
Yeah.
It's like, yeah. Oh, no, I think it's a dead guy. Turned out it wasn't a dead guy. They managed to revive him and all, but it was like, scared the shit out of dude.
Yeah.
That ended his little bar fight hobby thing.
Yeah, you stopped doing that.
Why do, who thinks that's fucking entertainment?
I don't know. I had friends like that. And after working in a bar in college and kind of seeing those guys, now in hindsight at 30, now I look back at it and I'm like, in my armchair psychiatry, I'm like, that's just some dude with some pent up, with some sexual suppression. I think it's manifesting in that way. What was that movie? It's that movie where the guy, he like goes out at night. And he gets, he like pays guys to beat him up. And he's like, I think you're gay, man. And he's like, no, I'm not gay. I like having guys beat me up. And then towards the end of the movie, he gets married to the guy that beats him up. It's like some little side thing in a movie.
Wait, what?
It's not like the main thing. It's not like the main plot. It keeps popping up on the side. It's like, where'd you go last night? He's like, I think I paid some guys to beat me up again. They're like, what? I think you're gay, man. And he was like, no, I'm not gay. And at the end of the movie, he's like,
if you think of the name of this movie, text it to me or something. It's a fucking, like, let me know, because I need to see this.
It's this guy's hilarious. He's like, yeah.
Oh, we just had a little rain band come through.
Yeah. But at the end of the movie, he's like holding hands. He's like, this is my boyfriend. And they ended up getting together. But okay, the first gap was I had to get a lamp. Now I got to pee. Sorry, Roger.
Might as well do it now.
All right.
Roger, monologue. Greetings from Hurricane Zeta, where we just had a rain band about 6 inches wide come through. Other than that, not much happening. Oh, Dad, if you're watching this, I got your computer over here. See you Saturday.
Yeah, okay, so nuclear bomb, even we didn't know. Okay, and then the six get together for the first time.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
So, and to set this up too, in the larger story, I've had several scenes set at the top of the Mark in San Francisco. In
the top of the what?
The top of the Mark. There's a world famous bar at the top of the Mark Hopkins Hotel in San Francisco, and I've been there a couple of times. Okay. It's they're very famous for their martinis.
Okay.
And I decided in the curators to make sure that this place survives.
Okay.
For a very long time.
Okay.
But this actually occurs right as the bar is being open, and so
okay,
so as you'll hear,
yeah.
Okay. But anyway, there's a there. If you had been reading the series, the fact that this is occurring at the in the Mark Hopkins Hotel would be significant because I keep putting shit there.
Okay.
Okay. So, 1945.
What part is this? Is this eight?
This is number nine.
Oh Jesus.
Of the, it's actually book three, number 11, because I skipped a few episodes having the prefaces like this.
Gotcha.
So anyway, 1945. The six of us who had been watching humanity on behalf of the curators held our summit at the Mark Hopkins Hotel in San Francisco. It takes time for our epigenetic switches to change our appearance, so most of us didn't dare to be seen in the swanky new restaurant on the 19th floor. Instead, I rented us a generous suite on the 15th and arranged for room service. We didn't use names, so among ourselves, we referred to ourselves as E for Earth, 1 through 6, in the order we had been recruited. I was E4. E2 had had the Japanese beat and had managed to fold in time to catch the after effects of the Hiroshima bomb. We poured a round of Jim Beam and he raised his glass. To the end of this war at least, he said with a bit of a sigh, and we all toasted. But we knew it wouldn't be the last war any more than the Great War had been, and the next war would be fought with weapons almost as terrifying as a detuned fold drive. More terrifying, really, since while folding a world into its star kills everything, it does so pretty much instantly, so there isn't so much protracted suffering. I have been watching these people for 55,000 years, E6 said, and every time they do something magnificent, our handlers say it's crazy, and more evidence they will destroy themselves, and they keep not destroying themselves. This may be different, E2 said. You haven't seen what these bombs do. They don't destroy the whole world. Look at how they picked up after the last war and just rebuilt everything and went on. With humans, anything is possible. Up to a point, E1 said. He was in Chinese physical form. They have incredible constructive technology, but their destructive tech always seems to lead. That shouldn't be too surprising, I said. The question is, should we just stand by and watch in this volatile environment? Should a single individual with way too much power do something stupid? We've seen lots of stupid in the last 100 years with their genius. I want to see what they do next, E5 said. This bomb is a horrible thing, but it's a magnificent horrible thing. Nobody in the history of the galaxy has ever realized such a thing against such odds and obstacles. What could they do if they put that effort into something constructive? Like what? I think only the humans themselves can decide what might be important enough, I said. We talked through the night. Each of us had seen things we were pretty sure had never been seen before in the whole history of the Milky Way. We might not be able to save humans from themselves, we eventually agreed, but as they attained powers we had never seen before, with an obvious lack of the impulse control we had been taught as curators, it seemed irresponsible and even cruel to not at least try to help them. We were done being passive spectators.
I like it. I like the sort of, it almost seems like hands-off approach, right? It almost like, yeah, right? It'd be like, I'm trying to think of an analogy. It'd be like if the the underdog got to the Super Bowl, right? All, leading up through the whole season and the playoffs, everyone's saying, you should do this, you should do that. And now they got to the Super Bowl, and all the pundits are saying, they should do this, they should do that. And one of them's going, I think we should let them figure it out, because they've figured it out so far. What do we know, right? Because we keep saying they're not going to do it. Here we are.
Well, that's what these six guys are basically in that position. They're like
the commentators.
And you got to remember, they're a member of a culture that's literally billions of years old.
I mean, yeah, they're gone.
They are all literally millions of years old. They've all been tens of thousands of years in human bodies. And they all came here to watch us, flame out.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're watching us, okay, do some really spectacular shit, but in the end, we're not doing the flame out thing.
Yeah.
And they're trying to tell their handlers that this is not quite what you think it is.
Yeah. Right.
And they're like, no, we've been doing this for 7 billion years. Fuck off. Just let us know when they kill themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
and they're here going, Houston?
Yeah. No, yeah. We're watching something magical, right? It'd be like if you could be a fly on the wall and watch Eminem, right? Like Marshall Mathers. You'd be like, this guy's fucking doing drugs. He's getting in fights. His friends are getting shot. He's manufacturing cars in Detroit, and he's throwing everything at doing rap battles. You're like, you keep watching, and finally you're like, they're like, has he died yet? And you're like, hold on. He just met someone named Dr. Dre. Like, let's see what happens. And they're like, he's going to die. And they're like, dude, I just saw him fucking throw down a freestyle, and he burned down the house. Like, let's see what happens, right? So that's what it is. The A-bomb's Dr. Dre, and they're going, let's just see what happens, right?
Yeah.
That's what I'm getting at.
Well, the human race is Eminem in this story.
Yeah, it is. It's 8 Mile.
Oh, my God. I'm trying to think of some of the people whose brains would melt.
That's what it is, though, right? That's what it seems like, right?
And I'm not even like one of the guy's big fans. It's like I appreciate his
yeah, yeah, yeah. It's I'm like, not a killer.
But you got to see what he fucking did, and the movie was fucking spectacular.
I mean, there's an interview with him. Yeah, there's an interview with him, and he's just like, he's talking about like throwing tapes out to people at the end of shows, just like, and he's like, man. And he's like, I'd thrown out like 1,000 tapes over like a year to people. Hey, Jay. And he's like, and I was so pissed off. And he was like, I just finished second place in some rap battle. And he was like, I'm so finished. And some guy came up to me and said, hey, man, do you have a tape? And he's like, and this is Eminem talking. And he's like, and I had given so many tapes to so many people. And he's like, and part of me just wanted to be like, fuck you. But he's like, for whatever reason, I took one of the tapes and he goes, and I just said like, whatever. And I kind of flicked it at him. Like, with an attitude. He's like, admittedly, with an attitude. Well, that guy was friends with Jimmy Ivey, who I know worked with Dr. Dre. And Jimmy Ivey played it.
Ended up producing him.
Yeah, yeah. And he played it and played it to Dre. And then it cuts to Dr. Dre. And he's going, and I listen to this thing. And I go, hold the fuck up. Play that back. And he goes, you get me with him. I will sign him. So that's kind of what it was. It was just like, fuck this. And yeah. And it shows Eminem. He goes, Dre comes up to me and goes, I love your work. And the guy goes, what, how'd you feel? And he goes, man, I swear to God, I started pissing my pants right there. he goes, I thought I was going to start pooping right there at Interscope Records. Just start pooping my pants. Let's go on. Number 10. Yeah, so humans are Eminem. Okay. Humans are Eminem.
So, next part. 1963. Wow. Our pack to help the humans of Earth ran into a snag pretty quickly. We soon realized that we knew no more about the technologies humans were developing than the humans did themselves. We were so far ahead of them that we had completely forgotten the basic techniques that were the precursors of our own vastly superior technology. So we watched with genuine interest as they developed techniques of information processing that were within their reach to implement. It turned out that we knew no more about nuclear reactions than they did. Because nuclear reactions are mostly useless once you understand how stars evolve and you have the fold. When the test bomb Castle Bravo ran away and harmed many of its observers, we were as surprised by the unanticipated side reaction as its builders. It did not occur to us that chemically powered missiles could reach space, or that they could be used to deliver nuclear weapons with hardly any warning until the humans demonstrated these things. As always, those who had recruited us pointed to the resulting hair trigger situation as proof that humans would destroy themselves. But the thing we observed then was the humans seemed to be aware of the problem too. When the human mathematician John Nash proved that the hair trigger could be made more stable, few off-world curators could even understand his argument. There was a period when our biggest worry was that an accidental failure might set off the hair trigger despite the stabilizing influences humans had inserted into their own control systems. We did make preparations to throw the biggest spanner we could into the gears of their nuclear command structure if we had to, but there were only six of us, and it was a massive enterprise. Fortunately, we broke lucky, and they began drawing down their overkill capacity before anything like that had a chance to happen. They did come close a couple of times. We were prepared to intervene in the event they came to call the Cuban Missile Crisis, since there were only a few ships and missile installations directly involved. But it turned out that the humans present managed to avert the danger on their own. We did not understand the dangers of nuclear energy because we had never had the need to make use of it. And so the contamination and reactor accidents took us by surprise, too. We also took note that they were altering their world's climate. That was something we did understand. But we could think of no way to alter their behavior without effectively curating them. Since there was a gradually evolving understanding among humans that making big war would be at best ineffective, the powers of Earth pursued other ways to gain influence and assert their geopolitical positions. The global superpowers interfered ruthlessly in the affairs of smaller nations, and as much as they dared with each other's politics through propaganda, blackmail, and other methods. And like most humans who are alive then, all six of us remember where we were on November 22, 1963, when we got the news that the popular and inspirational American president had been assassinated.
Keep going.
Number 11, 2060. Our handlers pretty much left us alone because it was obvious they had no real idea what to do with the humans of Earth. The original plan to let them kill themselves with their precocial toys was not working out, because while they did keep creating disasters, they kept recovering and not going extinct over them. The next big thing was going to be the loss of all their world's ice, which would drown many of their major cities and create a lot of dangerous new weather patterns. But none of us who had been directly observing them believed this would lead to the species going extinct. There would be much suffering and destruction, but then the survivors would rebuild better than ever. That is what they always seem to do. But then we received word that they were planning to violate the quarantine of a new critical path world. This was an affront which could not be tolerated, and I drew the assignment of making sure they knew this was not acceptable. I watched their improbably complicated craft drop from space and alight on the soil of a world that they didn't realize was forbidden to them. And I realized that I was seeing something that had not been seen in aeons and never by any other currently living curator. A ship was landing from space without ground support. This is a thing the nanites had been cleverly crafted to prevent. And the humans had simply gone around that because they didn't even know it was supposed to be a limitation. I let them see me fold out, and it had exactly the effect I intended, only more so. I watched from a distance as the pilot raved that they had to figure out how I had done it, and her companion, the ambassador, had to remind her that they had been warned to leave by something with that very power. In that moment, I admired them both, and I did not yet know I would eventually become their friend.
I love it. I love it. I love that line. They didn't even know it was a limitation. I love that. That is fucking inspirational. Is, yeah, is don't, You can't do that. Oh, no one told me I wasn't supposed to. I fucking love that.
And so you'll probably like the final reading that I have on our agenda, which is that scene from the other point of view.
Okay.
From book one, number six, when M and J meet the being who will eventually become Andrew, whose viewpoint we just heard. This is from the viewpoint of the character J, who starts out as a dermatologist.
Okay.
Ends up being the ambassador from Earth to the entire galaxy. And this is our first interstellar trip.
Okay.
In a starship that humans built.
Okay.
"We'll be on the ground in about half an hour," M said from the front seat. "We won't burn up. We don't have orbital velocity. We'll fall until we can glide, and then I'll start the engines to land us." This all went well, according to plan, until we landed in a clear area and popped the cockpit bubble. "Aren't we the first humans on this world?" I asked as Em took off her pressure mask. "Of course, the aliens don't come here, and this is the only human starship." "Well, then how is it there's a human being standing at the edge of the clearing?" He gave the appearance of being a well-groomed British gentleman, and he watched quietly as we stowed our gear and departed the StarCraft. Once we were on the ground, he approached and offered his hand, which we shook cordially. M deferred to me, as I was supposed to be the ambassador. "I thought we were the first humans here," I said, with an attitude of respect and slight surprise. "Oh, but you are," he said with a smile. "We perfected the art of walking among our children aeons ago. If I presented at any of your most advanced hospitals, they would never suspect I am an alien, but I am, in fact, one of those you call curators." "We came here to find you," I said. "I know. Earth is my normal assignment, obviously, but I was tasked to come here and intercept you when we realized you were going to break quarantine. Your cosmic acquaintances are both young species, like you, barely out of quarantine themselves, and they did not understand and therefore communicate just how dangerous this is." "Why?" "We do not care much about what happens to species that have not reached the start of the critical path. They live and die all the time, accomplishing nothing, arousing no interest, and we consider it a duty of those species that have completed the critical path and gained space travel to learn to deal with the challenges they will find in the vastness of space and myriad interactions of interstellar commerce. Should you attempt a rampage of conquest, they should be able to defend themselves. But the species on the critical path are interesting to us, but vulnerable to premature influences and not yet able to defend themselves against invaders armed with high technology. We do not want you to recruit or proselytize them or impose an order here. We want these beings to define their own order, to refine it, to reinforce it, and then to take it to the galaxy to participate in the vast garden that we have been creating for almost 8 billion of your Earth years." M spoke up. "You don't seem to have cared much for us on our critical path," she said with a sharp tone of bitterness. "Your belligerence worried us," the curator said, unfazed. "You are far more willing to murder your brothers and sisters than is usual. We decided to develop you slowly so that you might have time to mature beyond this impulse, but it happened that every time we thought it was a suitable time for a development, you had either done it already yourselves or were about to. In the latter cases, we allowed you to advance on your own so that you could own your achievement. For all your troubles, your species has made remarkable accomplishments. Even though you made it from a murder weapon, your craft here is a wonderfully and uniquely small and maneuverable starship. It didn't occur to you to intervene to help us with our belligerence rather than leave us to our own devices?" He shrugged. "It was a judgment call. Your rate of advancement has been startling. We underestimated the effect the threat of mutual murder would have even on those of you not inclined so much to fratricide, since you had to defend yourselves against the dangerous minority. Of course, your dangerous ones tend to find high office in your political systems, which is an ongoing problem. For aeons, our policy has been one of mostly non-intervention. Sometimes our children kill themselves instead of developing. It's a natural part of what we are trying to encourage. We have had other murderous children, but none so technologically successful as yourselves. And now we have the Fold Drive. Yes. It will be interesting to see what you do with it. It is as dangerous as it is useful. Only a handful of species in all of our experience have ever gone to the trouble to build nuclear weapons. Actually, well, anyways, later developed, that was Zero. This was a series.
Yeah.
I amended that
later. Yeah.
Nobody ever did this before. Okay. The ability to make a big, messy, poisonous explosion is rather unimpressive next to what a Fold Drive can do, and most of our children get the Fold Drive without ever building the massive industrial works you have made. And with nanites, any individual person who wants to can make a Fold Drive. Exactly. So what happens next? You leave this world and don't come back to any critical path quarantine world. We mostly consider you your own and our children's problem, but we will not tolerate interference in our gardening. The civilians misled you on one point because they don't know the truth themselves. Our standards are reasonable, and none of our children have been stupid enough to fold their homeworld into its star by accident once we gave them the proper configuration parameters. But a few worlds have been folded into their stars. We do not seek to create an ordered formal garden. We want to be surprised by our children. Nothing would be more boring and pointless to us than a galaxy full of life that we design performing some perfect specification. But even so, once in a while, we do have to weed. Is that a threat? Emma asked sharply. Just a warning. Our requirements are few and reasonable. I will give you half an hour to depart. If you do not, you will never see Earth again. And he disappeared into thin air. What the hell? Em rushed forward and pawed the ground where he had been standing. Tell me he didn't fold out from the surface of a planet. He folded out. He didn't take any of the vegetation or leave anything of himself. There's no air pressure prop. How the hell did he do that? Remember, at this point, the human's understanding of fold technology is the fold makes a sphere.
Okay.
Come on, we have to leave. We have to find out how he did that. And we never will if he folds us off to the other side of the galaxy, which I think is what he was implying if we don't leave. He just showed us something extremely valuable. And what's that? We're nowhere near being able to do anything like this. No, but now that we know it's possible, we can start trying to figure out how he did it.
Oh, touche, Roger. I like that. I like that a fucking lot. Leo Szilard vibes. Fuck so, yeah.
That was my dramatic reading for tonight. Now, I was going to make a suggestion.
Sure.
Okay, a challenge.
Okay.
Because I know you have a problem with the reading thing. Not, you know,
audiobooks.
Yeah, it's like get the robot to read it for you because reading doesn't work and all that. Okay. So I would like to make a suggestion.
Okay.
A gentle challenge.
Sure.
I sent you the link for the first episode of The Curators. I would like to challenge you to read one episode a day. They're short. They're all under 2,000 words.
Okay.
For 1 week, which will bring you to the excerpt that I just read you.
Okay.
Incidentally. And that's it. You know, it's just to give it a try.
Okay.
Because the thing about it is that I've known other people who had the reading block. You know, it's like they're capable of reading, but it's a chore. It's difficult. It's a pain. It's like you don't look forward to it. It's like, oh, crap, I've got to read this
thing.
Okay. So what I would like to suggest is that when I wrote this, it's a serial. So it's in little bitty chunks, each of which has a hook. Because it's a fucking serial. So it's got to have something to bring you in for the next part.
Yeah.
And so I would like to ask you to just give it a try.
I'll give it a try.
Okay.
I'll give it a try.
And if you report to me next Wednesday that it's just not fucking working out, then okay, that's fine. All right, whatever. You know, but, you know, the thing is, the way you improve these things, if you can, is by doing it. And I know how you get into this mental trap of, you know, when you do have to read something, you're dreading it.
Yeah.
So there's no positive feedback, even when you manage to do it.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking if you like this, you know, you get a little endorphin thing, you know, you get a little positive charge out of each of these episodes, and don't push yourself. It's like I'm saying, just saying one a day. Don't push it. Don't think, oh, yeah, I was like, okay, just do one and ask yourself if you want to do that. Yes, yeah, do the first six or whatever until we get to next Wednesday, and then just tell me how it went.
I'll do that. I'm open to it. I'm open to the challenge. I'm open to growth.
Yeah, you know, and I honestly don't know how well it will work because
me neither.
You're 30 years old. And I don't know if the human brain is still plastic enough at that stage.
Yeah.
But I think it might be. And I think if you enter a situation where you are reading and getting rewards, and you know, instead of it being
a chore,
just this fucking nuisance that I've got to deal with, you know, then it might help to open it up and, you know, well, it's like, whatever. It's like, I'm not a fucking professional or anything, so.
Yeah. I'm down to open it, to open up. Yeah, maybe dopamine is the water, and the more moist you get the soil, the more neuroplasticity of your brain increases.
I think that's a possibility.
I'm open to it.
And the thing is, you know, when I created this thing, I didn't know what the fuck I was doing. It was, you know, but it just broke all the records as far as, I thought it was going to be a one-off story. And my wife was like, oh, man, you have a lot more to say about this universe. A lot more to say about it ended up being 120 episodes.
200,000 words.
200,000 words. And it's like, but it's in little teeny chunks, each of which has a hook to get you into the next one.
Yeah.
And there was no point in the whole creation of this thing where I was more than 10 episodes in the future knowing what the fuck I was going to do. And that in itself is like, I would say, if I was talking to someone who was a writer, I would say that is one of the best exercises I have ever done in my life for myself.
Really?
As far as this right, as like, there's no way I would be contemplating doing Topi if I had not done the curators.
Yeah.
Because it got me back in touch with, for, you know, what the freaks, you know, my muse.
Yes. Yes.
And it was just, you know, and I'm really fucking proud of it.
Yeah. It's as well as you should be. And that's kind of, I described to a friend of mine that loves this podcast, it's kind of what you're saying. I tell him that looking out at this thing, I always visualize it as like, I always visualize like a bunch of like, almost like the Matrix rain, Like, I'm standing here, and like when I'm like I'm walking on the street, I visualize it as like there's like a river of like Matrix rain, and it's flowing away from me, and I see it's branching off into potential guests, and each guest branches off, almost like a chain reaction, like Leo Szilard. But I can never see farther. Whenever I visualize this, and I don't do it intentionally, I'm not like, let's think of this. I sort of just let it happen. I see it branching off. I'm going to get this guest, and maybe that breaks to here and breaks to here. But it can never go more than like 10 or 15 feet in front of me. Because what happens is it hits this like inverse waterfall. It just, it goes straight up. And what that is to me is I've now come to see that as that is the event horizon. I don't know. It's the singularity. It's just, so it's like, hey, man, where do you see this podcast in a month? I'm like, I can tell you where I see it in 8 days, upper limits. Like, but it's kind of like what you're saying, though. I'm like, aside from that, like, understood physics, like, breaks down. Nothing, we don't get it. It's like light slows down, time goes backwards. Like, you divide by zero. But it's a very good, in a lot of ways, it's kind of like the curator. You have limited resources in that you could say that time and forecasting is your limited resource. So by not knowing, or Eminem, you could say that like by only going in freestyle and you got to rhyme with this because I have to take a piss and tomorrow is another episode. And like, I don't know though, right? Cause, and so I just break that rhyme because I don't know. But when you're always looking for the word just in front of you,
yeah.
God damn, man, if that doesn't make you like learn quickly, right? Sink or swim.
You know, I don't know if I told you, but we had a rap battle on Corrosion back before Corrosion died.
Oh, yeah?
And of course, it wasn't spoken because it was all written word. But we had a thread that was a rap battle, and I was declared the winner.
Fuck yeah. Fuck yeah.
But the rhyme that got it for me, to Asimov, I have sometimes been compared. You ought to check out an opinion he aired. Though violent energy must sometimes be spent, it's still the last refuge of the incompetent.
Touché. But it's... Yeah, there's something about that sort of, right, that freestyle.
And I was the thing is, after that weekend, you know, when we were doing that, because that was like the 50th post that I put, and it was like, you can't fucking stop thinking in rhymes.
Yeah. Like, oh, yeah.
It was like...
I would imagine that.
Getting out of that habit was like, it took me 3 or 4 days to stop fucking thinking in rhymes.
Yeah, it's... But if you ever watched, there's like a Mac Miller freestyle, I think, or one of the early Eminem freestyles in that same video I was telling you about. He's like, I can't play it because I don't want to get my channel yanked. But it's him doing a freestyle. But it's fucking amazing. It's, yeah, but the ending line is, I'll beat your ass like a jealous husband. Like, and that's like the finishing line. And like, it's just amazing. But yeah, he's shitting on the guy. He's like, because he wrote 90% of this. And when you go looking for your freestyle, it comes up missing like Snoop Dogg's police files. But he's just...
Well, the thing is, in the rap battle on K5, I spent most of it doing Dr. Seuss shit.
Yeah.
It was like, you're doing Eminem, I'm doing Dr. Seuss. They're doing all this violent shit. It's like, I'm going to mess your shit up. I'm going to take your head off. I'm going to...
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
Like, and I'm just like, you know, and I'm doing, you know...
Cat in the Hat.
Yeah, it's like I'm literally doing Dr. Seuss style rhymes and all, and we're bantering with this, and then it was like that last one that I just told you. It was like the one that sealed the deal, and it's like then one of the side guys just said, "Okay, I declare you the winner."
Winner.
It was
winner.
Boom.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
It's.
And the sad thing is it's not online anymore because Corrosion went off of the air and I don't have a fucking copy of it.
I think, you know, I've come to start to view that stuff that's vanished from online. I start to appreciate it more for what it is. Like, I go way out of my way to make sure my podcasts survive. But
yeah, I know. You got the nuclear bunker there, and you're safe with the terabyte hard drive.
I got NORAD, dude. I got NORAD
bag and all that shit.
It's got three tiers of Faraday shielding. Three tiers of Faraday shielding, five tiers of waterproofing, two tiers of fireproofing. I'll die and they'll find this thing. They're going to uncover this thing in 600 years.
Yeah. You're not even getting hit by a hurricane right now.
But that's what this thing is for. This thing is... NORAD over in the corner. This fucker. That's what this thing is meant for. It is... Right now, I could... no hyperbole. I could go get a jerry can of gasoline. I could dump it over this thing, light it, and walk out of the house and wait for the fire department to come and put this whole thing out. And then there could be a solar flare. and then we can take the rubble and go dump it in the pond out the end of the neighborhood. And I can go in 72 hours and yank this bitch out and it'll be just fine. It's my podcast. And then it's kind of like Leo Szilard, right? The real secrecy is that it's possible at all. The real safety of this NORAD safe is that there's nothing worth stealing. Because it's just my podcast. It's like, what is it? Is it blackmail and politicians? Yes. Nope. It's all online. There's nothing to
you
take.
You got all the trouble to break this safe and all this shit, and all it is...
You can go to YouTube,
a hard
man.
Drive with these podcasts.
You can go to YouTube, dog. You can get it all online. That's all it is, though, but... I kind of like it. I like the challenge of can it survive? Yeah. That's what I got right now. But yeah, it's... I like it. I like the idea of the curators. I do like the idea of... It's something I've kind of toyed with more. I do like the idea of there being, like, beings on this earth who just look identical to us. And I don't mean that in some, like... You know, reptiles run the world. No, but I just like the idea of someone popping in and just going in full camouflage and just sitting in, like sitting in on a college class. But the rule is you can't fuck with it, right? You just sit in and watch.
Well, I mean, the thing is, if there is a galactic civilization, the question is, where the fuck are they? And so making it compatible with the fact that we exist and this is our lived existence is kind of a challenge if you're a science fiction writer, I think.
Yeah.
So, I mean... The whole thing with the curators is I wanted to take their challenge to do, you know, human primacy things and, you know, human exceptionalism.
Yeah.
And I understand the reason that their group exists because, yeah, if you look at it from a certain point of view, the movie Avatar was really kind of annoying.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It's like, yeah, we're the bad guys. We're fucking incompetent. We get our butts kicked by these primitive people that don't even have radio or anything.
Yeah, fuck and that. Yeah. So, humans would have won. We would have just napalmed it from orbit. Fuck off.
Yeah.
Fuck out of
here. So it's like, no, seriously. But on the other hand, I didn't want to. And the thing is, if you read it, an HFY is a really friendly group if you're a writer. That is the thing that attracted me to them, even though this wasn't like my primary attraction as a topic, but it was that they are a really friendly group to writers as far as giving you an audience, giving you positive feedback, you know, and not asshole feedback. You know, it's like, you know, they're not bad about it. You know, every once in a while you get a story that doesn't, you know, follow their trajectory. So I thought it would be fun to do something that explored that space of human exceptionalism.
Yeah.
But in a different way, and in the, you know, so it took me 2 years to do all this. And at that time, I was reading HFY every day. And it's like, when you read the Meta posts, one, you know, there are a couple of big things that keep coming up over and over again in the Meta discussions. Well, one of them was, I got blue balls because this dude started this series, did 50 episodes, and disappeared and never finished it. And I was intent, I was not going to be that guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah. And a lot of people were like, they were, you know, when I finished up The Curators, I was like, I have to finish the thing. Yeah. It has to have an ending.
Yeah.
And oh my God. You know, so there are people who were like crestfallen. But on the other hand, it was like, well, you know, I can't continue doing this until the end of time.
Yeah.
So it has to either end, or I become one of those people you complain about with the blue balls because I had a series and I didn't end it. So yeah. I'm ending the series. I'm drawing it to a conclusion, which I think was a satisfactory conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what else can you do? Is it, you know, it's
yeah, it's, they're gonna complain. They're gonna complain if you pull the rug out from under them, or they're gonna complain because you should have ended it earlier.
Yeah,
it's right. It's gonna be like The Simpsons. They're gonna be like, you went too long, and it's like, well, fuck out of here. I can't win with you.
Yeah. So, I have to say that the audience at HFY was extremely good to me.
Fuck yeah.
I had excellent feedback. The criticisms that I received were always spot on. They were not bullshit. You can do a lot worse than to, if you're a writer, to write something for HFY. Yeah. But, of course, they, you know, that is their shtick. It has to be about science fiction story about humans pumping ass out in the universe. And, you know, and the thing is, the regulars, they actually have a list of tropes. It's like, okay, everyone does this. Humans are bigger, stronger, and faster than other aliens.
Yeah.
We don't know why.
Yeah.
Humans eat shit that's toxic to everything in the universe for fun.
Yeah.
We don't know why we're able to do that.
Yeah.
And so there's a list of like a dozen things like that, that are like the tropes of HFY. And I was trying to do something a little different.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was appreciated.
I liked it, man. I liked it thoroughly. And I'm going to take you up on your challenge.
Well, let me give you a skip you a step.
Okay.
And I'll read you the very first episode. Since I'm here doing dramatic readings tonight.
Let's do it.
Oh. The Curators, Part 1. It had been 3 years since the Foldship appeared in our sky, and I was a bit amazed to find one of our alien visitors on my appointment book. The aliens could travel between the stars, but had a very limited ability to move between their orbiting ship and the Earth's surface. So we had brought them a docking ring and with their help affixed it to their ship so that we could do shuttle service. There were thousands of individuals of several races from different star systems on their ship, but only a handful had actually made it to the Earth's surface. And now one of them was across my desk from me, and I had no idea why. I'm honored and puzzled, I said. You are your world's foremost expert on the patterns that emerge on the dermis of your species, it said. My visitor was bipedal, but had a chitinous exoskeleton and didn't wear clothes. Its color changed according to its mood. At the moment, it was bright blue. It spoke through an electronic translator that mimicked human inflection pretty well, and I had no idea what gender it was, or even whether our idea of gender might make any sense to it. I studied diseases of the skin, I said. Birthmarks are also part of my work. I am seeking the mark of the curators. None of your people have ever said anything about this. If I may, I made my terminal available and my visitor navigated to a diagram of two equilateral triangles arranged point to point. This diagram appears somewhere on the dermis of every multicellular species the curators have affected. He arranged a slideshow which quickly showed me the same design and colors on skin, colored and missing hair, colored and missing scales, and colored in differently textured chitin. If I may, it said. It stood and turned around, bowing slightly. There was the pattern, about 6 centimeters across and horizontal, at about the point a human would call the small of its back. I can't say I've ever seen that, I said. This is remarkable. I have observed the mark of the curators on thousands of individuals of hundreds of species and shared records of its occurrences on hundreds of thousands of species with my fellow researchers. What is its incidence? For intelligent species, it is 100%. I have to ask if your species' modesty habit might be hiding it for some reason. I assure you I have no prurient interest in your reproductive apparatus. I sighed heavily. This was certainly not something I'd anticipated in medical school, but I moved to the open floor and disrobed. The alien examined my body with the attention a lover might show, but a growing agitation that was anything but amorous. Its exoskeleton slowly turned green as its puzzlement increased. This is remarkable, it finally said, for the first time sitting down. I have studied the curators for my entire career, and to my knowledge, nobody has ever encountered a member of a species with language, much less space travel, that does not have the mark. Maybe it would help if you told me something about these curators. I have no idea what you're talking about, I said as I put my clothes back on. That is also remarkable. Every sapient species we know of has known of the curators. Well, I can assure you that we don't. I'm pretty well educated by human standards, and I think I would know if I did. The curators are vastly powerful, and they love carbon-based intelligent life. They do not intervene often in the path of any particular world, but when they do, as far as we know, their powers have no limit. When they find a lifeless world or proto-world with promise, they intervene to improve its chances of becoming life-bearing. When they find a barren but habitable world, they introduce simple microbic life. When they find a world where microscopic life has increased in complexity and remade the environment, they make sure it becomes multicellular. When they find a world where multicellular life has become complex enough to support intelligence, they insert key genomic factors to encourage that. When they find a world with life capable of understanding, they encourage the development of technology. But they also mark what they have altered. I suppose I shall have to find a geneticist. There is also a genomic mark which is less likely to degrade via evolution. As a doctor, I have access to the human genomic library, I said. What is it you are looking for? It gave me a sequence of about 100 base pairs, and I ran the search. This doesn't occur anywhere, nor does any subpart of it more than 20 pairs long. The alien became more agitated. This is truly remarkable, it said. Its color began to turn from green to dark violet. Perhaps these curators simply never came to Earth. Oh, no, they certainly did. The formation of your moon, which helpfully stabilizes the axis of rotation, almost certainly could. The occurrence of such large satellites around planets of this type is almost 20 times what might be expected by chance. Your Cambrian explosion. Also, curators, such an event has happened on every world we know of with multicellular life, and in many cases it is marked. Other possibilities are in the record, but most likely your KT impactor, which ended the era of the animals you call dinosaurs. Wait, if these curators love life so much, why would they hit our world with an asteroid and almost wipe out all life? They don't love life. They love intelligent life. Your fossil explorations draw a detailed picture. Your archaeologists are some of the best I've ever encountered. Life on Earth had stagnated in a stable pattern for tens of millions of years, with ravenous monsters dominating the most productive continents. The curators are known to intervene in this way in such cases. They left the coast clear so your ancestors could evolve into you. They love intelligent life so much and they're so powerful. Why don't they just make it from scratch? We don't know. That is a great mystery all of our races have pondered for literally millions of your years. We think they want to encourage, not create, and be surprised by what arises. So they create favorable conditions, but they do not directly create what they want. So how do they intervene to encourage technology? They leave gifts. Papers, drawings, artifacts. Every species has its tales of the mysterious package that gave the idea for steam power or electric power distribution or the fold interstellar transport. In fact, it's an interesting thing. We found your world because we detected an anomalous fold pattern, which we thought might be the signature of a fold ship in peril. But it turned out you were just commencing research and doing experiments. You hadn't had the gift to guide you. We've been helping your science finish the... Maybe we just did it ourselves without their help. I don't believe that has ever happened before, the alien said. Well, everything has to happen for a first time.
I like it. Yeah, because eventually you'd have to question, well, where do the curators come from?
Correct. Okay, but... Okay, personal challenge. You have to read the next part.
I'll read the next part. So I have Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Yes. I can read a Wednesday morning. So I'll be on part eight, right?
Yes. You'll pass the part that I read to you that was where J and M meet the curator.
Yeah. I'm taking the challenge.
And hey.
See what happens.
And if it's too much of a pain in the ass, I won't take it. At least it's like serious. I'm seriously curious.
So am I. If I really wasn't interested at all, I'd be like, hey Roger, love the idea. I don't fucking care. I have no qualms with saying that to people. As you can tell, I don't give a fuck. I'll try it. I like it. I'll toy with it. I'll play the game for a little bit. I'll try it out. I'll go on kindergarten mode. I'll try it. You know, I'll fuck around with a video. I'll fuck around with any video game for an hour, whether or not I'll keep playing. I'll fuck around with this. I'll dip my toes in. I'll dance. Yeah.
Hey, this reading thing, it doesn't have to necessarily be like painful, you know, it's gonna be like
Roger, are you a mafia boss now? This reading thing, hey, it doesn't necessarily have to be painful, guy, huh?
we can sweeten the pot. We can give you a taste, you know, we can dip your beak into it.
Hey, we can work it. Hey man, we can work something out, man. You don't have to be so bad, huh? I think I probably just scarred myself from college getting into med school. I think I probably just burned any love of textbooks or just text in general.
I think you develop a habit of dreading it.
Yeah.
It's like, oh my fucking God, I've got to read something.
Yeah.
And I can understand that. Yeah. But I'm thinking that this story was like, okay, you've been introduced to it now. I got my hooks into you. Okay. So it's like, give it a try. And the thing is, and because it was a serial, because it was structured this way.
It's structured to be readable.
You can take it in teeny little bite-sized pieces.
Sure.
So it doesn't have to be painful.
Sure.
And then, you know, it's like, and it still might not work. Because I, like I said, I don't know if at the age of 30, your brain is still plastic enough to rearrange itself. But I'm thinking, if it is, this is probably a pretty good potential tool.
Absolutely. It absolutely is.
Because as I say, it's like, you know, knowing that you find reading painful hurts me. It's like, I'm you know, it's because I read it like 200 words. And, you know, like,
yeah.
You're
a machine.
To me, it's like, and I've had conversations with people who have exactly your problem before. Mm-hmm. And you know, I tell them, it's like, okay, when I look at a written page, there's no effort involved. It's almost as if there's a narrator that pops up in my head and starts reading it to me.
Okay.
And yeah, obviously that wasn't the case when I was, what, 5 years old or something. You know, it's like it's a thing that develops with practice.
Yeah.
But if you've developed a block, you know, it's like you're thinking of reading as being painful, then when you do it, you're not, you know, encourage, you know, then you're not chipping away at that problem. You're just bolstering it. You're making it worse because you're just like, you're just contributing this. Oh my God, this is it's so bad. Fucking painful. This is so awful. This is such a fucking pain in the ass.
Yeah.
Instead of, you know, internalizing it and like greasing the wheels and making it easier for the next time. So I'm thinking this cereal thing might be the perfect thing if you want to take a jab at it.
I do.
To try and flex those muscles without it, you know, without it hurting. Yeah. If you find the story interesting, if the hooks each thing grab you, instead of it being, fuck, I've got to read this next thing, it's like, oh man,
yeah, let's see where it goes. Yeah,
then you get more and you do more of it, and then it's like, if you read 200,000 words, then you might find that you can dive back into something like the written version of Dark Sun.
Yeah.
And it's not such a big deal anymore.
Yeah.
You know? So it's like, it's like no guarantees or anything. I'm just like thinking, might be a thing worth trying.
What if this somehow just unleashes a monster onto the world? this somehow leads to something. You're just letting the monster out of the cage. It's kind of like there's like a shitty like Instagram like motivational picture I saw forever ago, but I do like it, and it's working out isn't a punishment for what you ate, it's a celebration of what you can do. And I like it. It's like, yeah, this isn't like, fuck, all right, fat ass, gotta get in there and work out. It's like, no, this is like a celebration of like, you can still stand, your muscles work, like you're not in a wheelchair, like, you know, celebrate it. It's like a beautiful mini sunrise or something.
Believe me, I get that. It's you know, I'm constantly astonished at the shit that I can't do anymore that I could do when I was younger. It's like, fuck getting old.
There's no turning around. It's all going downhill. But Roger, let's wrap this bitch up because I got an early one tomorrow. Relatively early, but I got an early one tomorrow. Friday, I'm having on Larry Holcomb, author of Presidents and UFOs. So, getting right back into it. Getting right, going balls deep into the flying saucers. That is my drug. I can never get away from that. That is my drug. You know what? Actually, there could be a perfect The Day After Roswell by Colonel Corso. It's this Air Force colonel who dealt with like the Roswell wreckage, supposedly. But he was super fucking high up in the Pentagon. And the narrator who reads it, by some chance, if this guy's listening, I apologize, is the single worst narrator I've ever heard in my 30 years of living. Dude, he sounds like a mix between Gilbert Gottfried and Elmer Fudd, who's slightly intoxicated. Oh, it's horrible. and like, I love UFOs. And he's like, and then the next day, there was a problem. I said Colonel Corso. And he looked at me and he said, dude, it is obnoxious. It's not just like slightly unenjoyable. It's painful.
So, and I was going to ask you what you think of my narration. Because
beautiful.
I'm perfect. Obviously thinking of doing audiobooks.
Yeah, I think you should. I think your voice is perfect for it.
Okay.
I'm always biased because I always want the author to read, regardless of their narrative voice. To me, there is something more. There's always something a little bit. I feel like I got cheated on when I finish a book and it's like book by Bob Smith, read by John Jones, and I'm like, who the fuck is John Jones? I'm like, get the fuck. This is a personal thing between me and Bob Smith, and you came in here and just fucking. You came in here and came into my special place. Yeah, so I'm biased. You
know, the thing is, doing these podcasts with you has made me aware that I have some verbal tics and little habits, like clicks and.
Yeah. Oh, I find it with myself, yeah.
That I do. And which I.
Oh, I think Roger's power just went out. Rest in peace, Roger. I think a hurricane just took him out. Well, we're going to wrap this bitch up anyway. Yeah, we can see the exact freeze frame we got as his power started to go out. Well, Roger, hopefully the hurricane didn't kill you. I'll give you a call or an email. Everybody, thanks for listening. Episode 229, Roger Williams, author of my favorite book, The Metamorphosis of Prime Intellect, and an awesome guy. This is so perfect. Well, hopefully the hurricane didn't fuck him up, and if he did, Roger, you've lived a great life. Yeah, it's completely gone now. Godspeed, Roger. I'll send you an email. Everybody out there, stay safe. Just because someone votes differently than you doesn't mean they're your enemy. Love you, love everybody. America is the best country in the world. Let's not get at each other's throats. 6 days till election. We're going to make it through this. We made it through the Cuban Missile Crisis. We're going to make it through COVID and riots. We got this. Big dick energy. Let's do this. Humanity. Much love, everybody. Thanks for being here.